All right, so it's September the 16th at 5:40 in the morning, California time, and Bob and I are going to be talking about various topics in McLuhan.
Now, Cameron, you mentioned in various recommended topics, just said call recorder warning, minimizing Skype's main. Oh, I dropped it down. I shouldn't do that. Let's look at what you said. Let's talk about figure ground as if there was an argument. Now, let me just bring up the particular item that you do you recall that? The thing
Sure, that
you said
was
to us?
number two on my list of suggested topics.
Right.
What I take to be a difference between us on the question of figure and ground.
Right. So I don't know what that would be. So why don't we let's start with that topic. What is it?
Okay. Well, you said in the past, you've said that you think I mix up figure and ground, and that I end up talking about figures and not grounds. And that you take it that you're doing the opposite, talking about grounds and not figures. And I've said that I think the opposite is going on. I think, from my perspective, you're talking about figures, and I'm talking about grounds. So just to sort of get into that topic,
Yes.
I would suggest that tactility. Might be a great topic. We both think that tactility is one of the keys to McLuhan. We both think that tactility is certainly not the same thing as the sense of touch, or at least the sense of touch in a physical sense. But I would say that tactility is very much of a figure, and that it's a figure of a deeper complex that can be talked about in terms of tactility, but only when we keep in mind that tactility is a figure and not itself the ground.
All right, so tell me about it. I don't know. You're saying tactility is figure, so what's the ground?
Well, I would say that the ground. Let me take one other example so that what I'm talking about may be clearer if we talk about not only tactility, but let's talk about cold fusion as well.
Yeah.
I say that co cold fusion is a figure on a deeper ground, and that if we talk about cold fusion and tactility as if they were grounds, then we're making a very basic mistake in the reading of McLuhan and the thinking along with McLuhan. What's happening in both cold fusion and tactility is that there is a fundamental complex in the etymological sense, right? Plex. In Latin is the same word as English fold, and a complex is something that is folded together, something that is inherently complex, but not in a separated way, in an organic way. And both cold fusion and tactility are figured examples of that ground.
Okay, so when McLuhan says the medium is the message, I've come to start saying that the medium is not the new technology, not a cold fusion battery that's bought by enough people where it starts to be an environment. That's a figure. The ground is all the technologies and cultures and mythologies that the culture has already before a new technology comes in. So when McLuhan says the medium is the message, we can't tell what the new figure is doing to us until we start noticing what's happening to the past. which then might get into your time in the sense of past, present, future. So time would be the ground if we have an expanded deep sense of time, not clock time, but all that is preserved in the culture through speech and other media. How am I doing? What do you think of that as a definition of ground or medium?
Well, let me just make clear that when you say, how am I doing, I don't regard our relationship here in our conversation as a sort of teacher pupil.
No, I don't mean
I may have to learn from you more than you from me.
I know, but when I said, how am I doing, I didn't mean, do you agree with what I just said?
Yes, I do agree with it, but that's still, that's all at the level of figure, because I take it that ground has to do with the possibility of those things being the case.
What are those things? Past, present, future?
Well, the fact that the things that you were talking about, namely the environmental ground of a medium, that is intelligible. How is it that we can know these things? How is it that although all of our thinking is inherently limited, how is it that we can know things like the things that you're talking about? And once we know them, can begin to apply that knowledge in our lives. How is all that possible? I take it that ground has to do with this possibilizing of intelligibility.
Okay, so when people toss around the phrase, the medium is the message, they say, oh, sure. look at this, Web 2.0, it's a new technology, it's a new medium, let's see what effects are happening.
Right.
Where I think that's not what McLuhan meant. McLuhan said, you don't know what that new figure is doing unless you start noticing disturbances in what you already know.
Correct.
Oh, okay, good. So you follow that. And so the medium is the message, is the rearview mirror is the message, what the society already has and what you think it has. When there's sort of things not following what you want, then you have to say, what has crept into my home here that's disturbing the milieu? And then you might say, well, obviously we have Web 2.0 now, and that's, and I'm thinking like 10 years ago, that's something new. So there's the figure, but what's it doing to me? So my question would be, is just to see that there is a new technology, that's all there is to know. But the phrase, the medium is the message, is telling you to look at something else. Does one know how to look at the effects on the past? Or are you just bothered and you notice what you're bothered by, or what's upsetting, or what you're excited by?
Right.
See, I'm not sure how it's hidden, the new figure. If I start to notice things happening on what I already understand, the technologies, culture, and knowledge I have. Does that make sense?
First off, did you say you didn't understand how it was hidden? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I was just starting. I was starting to think that.
Propose something that I think is very important in reading McLuhan, and not only McLuhan. When we're thinking about questions like this, we should think about a child first learning to speak, and the child's rear view mirror. I cannot identify the speech that it hears, maybe already in the womb or maybe after the child's being born. At some point, the child learns that its rear view mirror tells it nothing about what is being said to it. It begins to understand the notion of communication. It doesn't understand it in the abstract, of course, but it begins to understand that it's participating in some sort of dialogue situation. And it breaks from the rearview mirror and begins in a process that Plato talked about as a spark that goes between people. The child begins to understand in a practical way that it's in this sort of dialogue situation. And we could say, okay, what's hidden? Well, what's hidden is everything that the child will ever learn about language in the 60 or 70 or how many years it's going to be alive. So 99.9999% of language is hidden from that child, number one. And number two, all of the peripheral things to language is hidden from that child. And number three, most important, the possibility of this happening is hidden from the child. Now, this same situation is always taking place with humans. You say, well, here's a new technology, it's 2.0 something. We cannot understand it in the rearview mirror. We cannot understand it in the future because we're not there yet. And we cannot understand the infinite penumbra around the thing. However, we do understand. So there is the dialogue situation, the possibility of the dialogue situation, the possibility of knowing within a penumbra of ignorance, all of these things have always happened. And so when we're thinking about the past, we have to understand that these things were operative there, but people weren't thinking about them. And it's just as operative now, and people aren't thinking about them. And what McLuhan wants us to do is to think about this in the future as we are looking at what's happening to us.
To think about it in what the technology would be in the future?
If we're just looking at, you know, where are we, what should we do, what are the problems, what can we do about them, what should we celebrate, all of these sorts of questions depend upon these unthought media, if you will, of the present. It's like Lewis and McLuhan both saying the artist is the person who tunes into the present. Well, what is that present? That present is what is the environment in which the child first keyed into communication. It made the biggest step of its life, but 99.9999% of it was unknown to it. Mm. And that's always going on. The human beings can speak, can understand, and it's a miracle, as you often say, quoting McLuhan, that communication can happen, but it's a miracle when it does.
Yeah, I think he said communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible.
Yeah. Correct. and that's exactly right. But real communication is always new.
Right.
There is no real communication in the real rearview mirror, because in the rearview mirror we eat or we consume what's being said to us rather than open ourselves up to what is being said.
Okay, so are you saying people are listening and talking, communicating too much with showing off their knowledge? Whatever the topic is that you're sort of objecting to the way humans like to know and think they know? That's your simple complaint?
No, I would say my simple complaint is that people aren't thinking because they exist in an environment like a fish, but they don't know anything about the water.
And they don't think about thinking about it. They don't think it's required. They are thinking about what they have to do, or whatever pressures are on them, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So we're talking about a thinking that is not dependent on pressures, fears, or raised incomes, increasing your income if you come up
sure.
with something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's something that's always going on in those things, but it doesn't have to be thought about. And even that is a very interesting topic, because what you're saying is that humans are somehow released to be not what they are.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting. How that could happen and why that happened, that's a very big thing.
Okay, so right now I'm listening to you and I'm being polite and attentive to what you're saying to figure out if you are telling me something. If we had a few other people on the line, some might say, I don't know what Cameron's talking about, let's go on to another topic, so they might interrupt you. Others might be interested, but they don't understand why you're bringing that up. So there'll be different responses, which always goes on. McLuhan defined the crowd as wealth. So you have this wealth dynamic happening in a crowd. If we had a crowd here, we wouldn't be able to judge who was perceiving and paying attention to what you were saying the most advantageous for all of us, right? We wouldn't know who is really actually doing the best listening. So it's best to be polite and not assume that you're getting it, or the only that you're getting it is the only thing required. Maybe someone else can contribute. So I'm creating a scenario of fairness in conversation. And
Yes, but in order to do that, you have to let go of notions like best understanding or who's doing it right. Those are the sorts of valuations that McLuhan said get in the way, because the dialogue situation is one where understanding and not understanding sort of go together. And what has to be done is to pursue the question.
right. Now, I feel I do this every week on my radio show with Ion. Ion's there to answer any questions, and people are reluctant. Sometimes they'll come up with a few things, but they're constantly constipated. They don't have the flow of questioning. And I tell them, look, we don't know what you're going to evoke by your question. So anything goes. I'm not judging anything you say. I might judge. It's what you're trying to say is not clear enough, or at least not to me. So what you're describing is what I'm proud of that I do. I don't judge anybody's contribution on the content level, just the topic, but I will judge whether they're getting it across clearly to me. Now, Ion often says, Bob, you don't need to understand this. We get what the person's talking about. So then I shut up. So I consider myself very polite, and I'm not a shock jock trying to cause controversy. I'm actually thinking we're sort of moving into a quietist situation where you're listening to your thoughts, to what people are saying, and to what Ian says. Now, I consider myself very good at that. But I look around and I feel other people are not doing what I'm good at. They're not paying attention to, and they're not interested in what people say. So, how do you get people into being interested without their pressured life of, oh, I got to get over here and do this. I got to go pick up my kid at school. I got to go shop. I got to apply for a job. Aren't you presenting the meaning of scholia, leisure? And you're saying people need to take a little more leisurely approach to interacting with others.
I guess so, but I would say that more important than that is recognizing that just thinking about the child again, there is a situation in which humans already exist, an environment. And our first need is to pay attention to that environment. And the first person that should do that is not somebody out there in radio land, it's me. So if I think about the situation in which we are already in, then I have to think that my role within that environment is not to worry about who's getting it or not getting it, but to attend to that environment.
All
And
right.
more than that, is sort of getting away from the ground.
Yes. Okay. So now, it sounds like to me what religion calls meditation, or what wisdom schools call, a kind of meditation, not necessarily the posture of meditation that people think they do on their yoga mat, but attending to most good thinkers, philosophers, perceptive people advocate that, don't they? What you're describing?
Yes, I think so. I think so, but you know, the in Zen, there is the what's called the ox herding koan, which talks about the development of thought in terms of a kid who's needs to herd an ox, and at the end of the progression. He comes back to the ox and starts herding him. The meditation that you're talking about, and I understand that you're exactly not talking about somebody on the yoga mat.
Right.
But at the end of the day, that comes back to just regular life.
Right.
There's not a separation between the meditation and going about our business.
Right. And most people look like they're meditating. They're not causing car accidents. They're going along, paying attention. And it's remarkable how many airplane flights there are and no accidents, at least not reported. It looks pretty, people look pretty civilized to me in general, right? So they're meditating. They're paying attention to what they think they attend to. Now, here comes, let's get right into what's called the present. Here comes Donald Trump. And they're saying this is the craziest election year ever, and Trump is a nut, or he's great. How would you apply looking at the Trump phenomenon or the election, or maybe you wouldn't even look at that? How would you apply your attentive methodology to this, to the stories? You know, McCune said the word makes a market, and definitely Trump is the word. He is a huge probe on everybody, and so many people think they have to react to it. Apply your what you recommend to the ground of Trump.
Well, I don't know that I would call him a ground, but
no. What is the ground of Trump, or how would you apply what we're saying we're trying to do to the Trump phenomenon?
Yeah, I guess I really haven't given that too much thought, but the fact that I haven't given it any thought is kind of my answer. I don't think that human beings at the present time can do anything about their enormous problems at the level of politics. Mm. I think that we need to pursue questions that McLuhan pursued, but hardly only McLuhan.
Right.
And only by deepening our consideration of everything is it possible that we're going to be able to straighten out the craziness of our lives as illustrated by Trump and by this election between two morons?
Okay, so you're not interested in how people interpret the value of what you claim you recommend. You're going to do what you just said you hope to do anyways, right?
But it's not as if I don't listen to people. I try to listen to people as best I can, and I hope to learn from people like yourself. But I don't believe that it's possible do much in the sort of the bubble of politics or political opinion.
Right. So, what is the ground of that figure? If we consider that figure a distraction or something that is really taking your attention off the ground, what is the ground that Trump is distracting us from? Or the election is? Sensible living is what you're saying.
I think that's the case, but I'm a little bit bothered by the idea that the question has the possibility of a clear answer. I mean, if you have millions and millions and millions of people and they're distracted in millions and millions and millions of ways, I'm not sure that you can come up with a good answer as to you know, what they're being distracted from. But sensible living, I think, is as good an answer as possible, yeah.
Right. So what would we talk about that you would think would be profitable to our understanding each other and moving towards a solution of consciousness or a solution of something, a better positioning for the future? Now, all those words can be silly, but I'm sort of asking you to take them seriously.
Uh-huh.
What are you suggesting we, how would we explore from our knowledge, especially our esoteric knowledge of McLuhan, what is required?
Right. Well, first off, if we look at the situation, the general situation of the world, what is new about our situation is that the power has become concentrated in politics in a way that's unusual for the history of the world. For most of the history of the world, there's been some kind of recognition that power needs to be allocated, shared, and mediated between politics and its military wing with religion as another source of input, and then science or research as another kind of input. And these things need to mediate each other. What's happened in the modern world, as McLuhan describes in Gutenberg Galaxy, say, and many people have made similar analyses, is that after the Renaissance, people began to think that intelligibility had something to do with an abstract unity, with a merging into a singularity. And although this was tremendously successful in thought, it's been very, very damaging socially, environmentally, militarily, etc., because the human might, if you will, has become focused in a way that's very dangerous, because our focus isn't offset by other equally legitimate foci.
Mm. There's no anti-environments, as McLuhan would say.
Yes.
And that is singularity, uniformity, conformity that started with the printing press? Is that what you're saying?
No, that's actually something that I think we could talk about nicely in terms of the anode cathode quotations you sent.
Okay.
Human beings are mergers. So when a child first hears a sound that he or she identifies as dialogue, or when the first human begins to speak hundreds of thousands of years ago or millions of years ago, whenever it was, language takes place through a kind of original sin, through a merging. The understanding is inherently partial, and
because it's merged.
Yeah, because it's a take.
Mm.
Right, as McLuhan would say.
Yeah.
And so the mystery of language is that language functions only by being limited. And when human beings forget about the limitation part and think that they are only dealing with light and intelligibility and forgetting about the dark and the finite part, then what happens is that you can get tremendous progress, but you get tremendous ignorance at the same time. And what we have in the modern world is a tremendous amount of progress linked to a tremendous amount of ignorance.
Yeah, so
so recalling original sin, you could say, is what's necessary. And I'm not a reader of Finnegan's Wake, but I think that the whole question of the sin in the park, what it was and why it happened and if it happened and all this, I believe is a big part of the book.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
And remember, now we're getting an echo. Why did that happen? Did you switch your phone?
No.
Okay.
Didn't do anything.
Okay, it seems to be not happening now. Okay. McLuhan, his definition of original sin was interesting. He defined it with the statement you've been emphasizing. He said original sin is the denying to notice what's going on.
Yeah.
Which is what you're stressing.
Yes.
Now, humans would argue over what is going on or how to attend it. So I'm aware of the debate over who's thinking their effort is more attending the present in the complementarity of services and disservices. That's what I see you emphasize, the complementariness. I don't know if you use that phrase, but in your writings, you're always saying, well, there's this, but then what about the other part, the complementary? What you were just saying was the bright part, the progressive part, and then ignoring the darkness. Is the yin-yang symbol an accurate symbol of what you're suggesting?
Sure.
Okay.
But that goes back to our discussion of figure and ground at the very start.
Right.
It's not as if the yin-yang is a ground. Yin-yang is a figure. And human beings never get beyond figures. So we have to, we always have to keep in mind that we're dealing with figures and that we're able to deal with figures only because there is a ground that's already carrying us and carrying that figure.
Yeah, the Zen thing, McLuhan quoted, medium is a massage of the jar is uses emptiness to be a jar. That's an example of complementarity.
Sure.
Now, I hear most people complain about the world, and they complain about that people are not smart enough, and they got to smarten up or we're in big trouble. Now, I'm not trying to say that you're doing that. You're doing it a little more eloquently. But I don't know what you would find valuable in more and more people hearing you. I don't think you would find that valuable, attending to what you're saying.
I don't find it necessary.
Right.
I might find it pleasurable. I might find it rewarding. But I do what I do because I feel like I need to do it. I don't do it because I'm aiming at a certain kind of communication or a certain kind of response.
Right. And what is it you're doing that you feel is useful, profitable, or beneficial, or towards a solution? I know you don't think there is a solution, and people forget that. They get very uptight about trying to get a solution. You remain in, you're not really here. You're just hanging around for your friends. You're in a curious position. Do you actually engage in any economic activity? Do you sell any of your services?
No, well, not the services like we're talking about here, but I've been a publisher, and I still, although I'm sort of semi-retired, I still work a little bit in two different companies that are involved in computer software and in digital publishing.
Would you like to get to a situation where you didn't have to do that?
No, no.
You like doing it?
Yeah, I'll do that until I expire.
Right. So do you find yourself irritated by the people you interact with in this business because they're not attending to something?
No, usually they're attending to whatever we're talking about more than I am. I have to learn from them.
Right. So what, I'm not sure what you think would be public about what you're meditating on.
What do you mean?
What would you throw into the pot? If you were in a conference now, like they're having a big conference on McLuhan in a couple of weeks in Toronto. Have you heard about it?
No.
Okay, so it's a lot of the recognized names are going to be there. So I'm not going to be there, and neither are you. Would you have to wait to see what was being discussed at the McLuhan conference before you knew how you'd respond or what you would contribute? Or would you have something you would contribute right now, no matter what, because you're familiar with the field?
No, I would want to know what was the topic of the conference and what the presenters were going to be talking about, and I would see if I had something to say in that context.
Can you predict, based on your awareness of McLuhan scholarship, what they are going to hear from you, what they're going to miss? And you know you can point out that, what they're missing. Or is that too presumptuous for you to think that?
Most McLuhan, quote-unquote, scholarship just doesn't rise to the level of thinking about what he was talking about. So I never read secondary literature in McLuhan because it's just not interesting. It's not thoughtful.
Okay, so when I read your articles, you're thinking, you basically have no McLuhan jargon in there. You might have a visual space or something, but you're not going in and playing with McLuhan's materials. You're fitting McLuhan into an ongoing dialogue or a thinking process that's been around for a long time. And that's how you talk about McLuhan. So you actually don't discuss McLuhan the way the scholars do, because they try to figure out what his words mean. You're saying McLuhan is worthy of consideration because he makes a valid contribution to the ongoing, well, I don't know what it's called, the ongoing dialogue, the ongoing traditional thinking, real thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Right. So
that means that you can't learn thinking by reading McLuhan. You have to be able to think and then read McLuhan.
Well, how would we know what thinking is?
That's a big question, right? Well, Heidegger wrote a book called What Would It Be to Think?
You question everything. There's not a theme, a meme, or an idea that you would undermine if someone thought they were understanding it.
if they were seeing the thing and according to its
Did you get knocked out? Maybe let's wait to see if he comes back in.
It may be that there is...
Okay, you're there. If you've been talking for a minute, I didn't hear any of it.
Oh, okay. I don't know why, but that's Skype for you. Skype isn't perfect by any means.
Okay, so you're going to have to repeat what you said the past minute. What were you? You were starting to say. about what is thinking.
Yeah, you said that I would
undermine
anything that anybody said, as if my purpose in life is to sort of be negative about things.
No,
but,
I don't mean that. You have valid reminding people of what they've left out, and you're pretty certain they will leave stuff out because you've observed humans and they're not comprehensive thinkers. They like to make some kind of superficial progress in their thinking. They're not trying to see the whole cancellation of time and no time, say. So
that's right. That's a difficult thing to try to say, as I'm not at all the first one to observe, because on the one hand, you want to make I want to make the criticism that people are not seeing the full context, the full medium in McLuhan's sense. But on the other hand, I want to say that there is no such thing as seeing the full medium, right? The seeing everything means seeing at the same time that you're not seeing everything.
Right. Yeah, you talk about that. You write about that. While thinking, you must be aware of the inadequacy of your thinking about the thinking that you're talking and thinking about. That
Correct.
Is, and that's not a disservice. It's useful to that thought is limited. You point that out often, too.
Right? Well, if you think of science, that's the way science works.
Yeah.
Science works by identifying ever new questions that need to be answered. But those questions are places where we're ignorant. So McLuhan often talked about how one possible future was an attempt to harness our ignorance.
As for wealth making, what's the particulars of that? How did he handle it?
Oh, he often talks, for example, he often said, look, people could identify what they don't know, and then if we could ask a million people about that, somebody would come up with a good answer. But the need is first to identify clearly what we don't know, what we're ignorant of. And he said most people don't know their own ignorance.
Right. So how would we get a consensus? Oh, maybe you don't think a consensus is required, but how will we get a consensus on which issue was the thing we were ignorant of, if it was some kind of...
Okay, you have to... Consensus has two different meanings here, one that I regard as negative and one as positive. I mean, all dialogue takes place through consensus, right, through a coming together of sensibilities. So that's always going on with human beings and needs to be, we need to be attentive to that. But if we mean how do we come up with the quote unquote right answer as a consensus, then I think that's a mistake. Trying to come up with something that is going to be stable and act as our new ground and things like this, that's what human beings are always trying to do, and it never works because ground isn't like that.
Okay, what is ground like, I ask at this point? What would you say it is like?
Well, that's, see, this is, I think, one of the things that McLuhan was constantly trying to think about and that he didn't quite figure out, but he didn't quite figure it out because it's such a hard thing to think about. And here McLuhan is with other people like Bakhtin or like Heidegger or like Pound. The question is, how do we think about the dynamics of thought that on the one hand can produce illumination, but on the other hand never gets away from ignorance and limitation? And how to think about this, even for oneself, let alone to communicate to others, is a very difficult question. And it's one that the people that are worth reading are always thinking about and are handing on to us to think about in our turn.
I just keep thinking that you're talking to yourself, and I don't know how to translate what you're saying into some program other than that I talk to you and I get some interesting thoughts or awareness from listening to you talk. So it's like you're a special pleasure, a vice. I will call up Cameron and he will question the procedures of that's going on all around him. Is anybody doing it right, or is there any right to be done? No, there's no right. So I'm not sure what you're looking for, how you would even begin to judge that we are in going to hell in the hell's basket, whatever that phrase is.
Well, again, let's think about the child first learning to speak, or about the first human who was able to speak to another human. First off, the possibility of communication is built into humans. It's not something that we invent. It's not something that we kind of build in some way. It's something in which we're already situated, and we can then, because we're already there, we can learn to feel our way within. So, if I say, "What the hell am I doing with this talk and this writing?" I mean, my blog is a kind of publication. I'm hoping soon, working with one of the companies that where I work, I'm going to be taking the content in the blog, and I'm going to be making POD print books and ebooks. And that'll be another way of organizing that material. And then I talk to people like yourself, and that's another way of sort of putting stuff out there. So then I say to myself, well, what am I doing when I'm putting the stuff out there? Sort of the question you just asked. Let's imagine that I'm a parent, and there's a newborn child there. And you're attempting to get speech across to the child. And so you say, are you hungry? Is there something going on with your diaper? Come here. How are you? All of these sorts of things. You're not, the child is not fully understanding any of this, but the hope is that the effort to communicate is gradually bringing the child into a new communicative situation. And so that's what the hope is for somebody who is thinking about these things, publishing about these things, talking about these things, is that that they're within the existing possibility of communication in which humans are already situated, that this is participating in the ongoing task of learning a language that is adequate to this situation.
Learning a language like a child.
That's what we're lacking, right? When if we're killing all the elephants in Africa or all the rhinos, heating the planet in a way that is going to destroy a lot of its life, or if we're killing millions of people in ongoing wars, a great part of the problem is that we do not have a language that is adequate to the understanding and amelioration of these problems. We exist in the night of the world where we're kind of dreaming our way forward, But we have no way of interpreting our dreams.
Yet you would say that's not a problem. It's not an overwhelming problem. That's natural that we don't know. You would include that.
But no, but Bob, there's a huge difference between if somebody let's say that somebody you have an infection and somebody gives you penicillin. The knowledge that you need penicillin and that penicillin will work, that knowledge is not complete knowledge of everything. There's a whole series of sort of ignorances that are built into that. However, that's to be distinguished from somebody else who says, well, you're infected, and so I'm going to stick a needle in a doll, and that'll heal you, right? Those are two different kinds of ignorances and problems. So I don't say that everything is just a big problem and reflects our ignorance. No, there's, we wouldn't be in the trouble we're in if we didn't know a huge amount about all sorts of things. It's just that we are, we're ignorant about our knowledge.
Well, how are you preparing for this horrible situation that's coming upon us?
Well, practically a person can, buy land in Idaho or Vancouver Island or New Zealand or something like that. And you can grow vegetables or whatever.
Yeah.
That's one way of preparing. I don't think that at the end of the day that I'm able to contribute to a solution other than attempting to further the ongoing effort of thought.
Okay, so
go ahead.
All right, let's go to the Bakhtin quote that you sent me. Let's see, where is that? Bakhtin.
Yeah, it was actually not from Bakhtin, it was from Renfrew's book about Bakhtin.
Right, so
I think, it could have been a quote within the Renfrew book from Bakhtin. I can't remember.
All right, so you suggest this for a discussion on satire. And the quote, first quote is from Rabelais and His World, page 11.
Yeah.
Far distant from the negative and formal parody of modern times. Folk humor denies, but it revives and renews at the same time. Bare negation is completely alien to folk culture.
Right.
Now, I'm going to read the rest of the quotes, too. Festival or carnival laughter is ambivalent. Quote, it is also directed at those who laugh, unquote. That's page 12.
Mm-hmm.
The folk, in quotes, the folk, in rejecting the finalized triumphant truth of official culture, do not pretend to a finalized indisputable truth of their own. It might therefore be said they do not pretend to a finalized indisputable truth of their own. Then, next clause, it might therefore be said of this ambivalent carnival laughter that it too is double voice, that carnival laughter is dialogic. Similarly, satire may be a carrier for the carnival spirit, as long as the satirist does not indulge in a one-dimensionally negative laughter which places him above the object of his mockery. Okay, so I'm not sure what you would say about this in relation to satire. I mean, he's trying to describe satire, but is there something in these quotes that it means Menippean satire to you? It's a Menippean attitude the folk have?
Well, of course, everything would depend on what was meant by Menippean satire.
Right.
Bakhtin talks about that a lot, but he talks about it in a very different way from, say, what Eric McLuhan does. So for Bakhtin, Eric's idea that Menippean satire is above all an attempt to change the hearer, I think Bakhtin would say no. Satire as a kind of, he calls it a second world. There's the official world, and then there's the world of laughter, the world of carnival, the world of satire. And these worlds are, for Bakhtin, very mixed. And I believe McLuhan had the same kind of notion. So if Menippean satire is taken to be the mixture of everything with everything, then it's improper to say that it's an attempt to put the hearer into a situation of communication, because that's too simple. It's too undynamic.
Okay, so
Right, like Bakhtin right here, he says a one-dimensional negative laughter is what would place the satirist above the object of his mockery instead of involving him in it. Right?
yes.
So the communicative situation for Bakhtin is not addressing a limitation in the hearer, it's addressing a limitation in which the speaker is himself or herself already involved.
Yes.
Right? So there's a satire is built into the foundation of the world.
Yes. That's sort of the doubleness of consciousness.
Doubleness of everything.
Right. Oh, that's what I want to say. So, if everything is mixed into everything, isn't that our present media environment, the global membrane, the global theater, and therefore we are witnessing a constant satire, a Menippean probe on ourselves?
Sure, but I think one of our differences is that you tend to think of that in a linear fashion, as if that was something new, and I tend to think of it in a non-linear fashion, as if it's something that has always been the case.
Right. Well, then why? So we've always been going to hell in a basket.
Certain way, sure.
Beg your pardon?
In a certain way, sure. But also we've been involved in a saving situation that is beyond our ability to distort.
What's it mean to be involved in a saving? Is somebody saving our situation?
Yes, of course, because the dialogue in which we're situated is not one that allows us to drown. It's if you say going to hell in a handbasket means the end of the world, the end of all life, the end of all hope, and all that sort of stuff, that is a merging. Everything would sort of merge into a night of non-being. But even a night of non-being exists in dialogue, so it's not the case that going to hell in a handbasket means everything is going to nothing. Nothing already exists in dialogue with something.
That's right. So if you, the way you, have a sense of urgency about where the world's going. I don't understand why you have that in relation to all that you're saying, the balance of sensibility you are expressing, yet you're worried about something happening. You know, where is this concern come in? Why are you thinking that we're more vulnerable today to some unforeseen catastrophe?
Well, I don't know that it's unforeseen. I mean, people know about nuclear weapons, and they know about pollution, and they know that
you don't trust management to keep that under control?
Management may be what has brought it out of control.
I detect you're placing yourself above the object of mockery here.
Not at all, because that's why I say I don't have a management solution to it.
Right, but why do you think that, what evidence you have is that things are not being done judiciously, beneficially for people?
What evidence do I have?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if people, especially old people and young people and pregnant people and non-combatants, are being killed around the world at a startling rate, and if whole species are disappearing, and if ecological environments are being destroyed, like reefs or like the cod fisheries at Newfoundland, et cetera, if this destruction is going on, it's not hard to be concerned about it.
You know, I engage ION a lot, and every normal problem, including death, ION spits at, mocks, says dying is the hardest thing to do. Every death's a suicide. So ION says very astounding, original, nonsensical to most people things. Like, for example, we would require more and more nuclear bombs going off because of the benefits of radiation for us right now, based on ION's definition of matter, and because we're consuming RNA drops, which requires more of the hydrogen isotope to mutate. So I could begin to tell you a bunch of stuff that ION cites that refutes the what seems to me cliche worries, like millions of people are dying. ION does not see that as a problem, people dying. The ones that aren't going to die, they're not going to cast off clay, are the ones that he's interested in, and there are going to be many of those. So here I'm saying stuff that doesn't fit our normal assumptions. I could carry on saying, well, you know, there's nobody dying of any consequence. Humans just leave. I'm trying to say, did you just
to
laugh?
To me, all of this is
did you
not,
just wait a minute? Did you just laugh?
Laugh? No.
Okay. So what? Now, what are you saying?
I'm saying, to me, all of this is not all that interesting because, let's say, somebody says, "Well, we don't need fewer nuclear bombs. We need more." The idea is that we're able to sum up a situation where there's tremendous destruction, and there might be some gain, and the summation is made such that it then comes out positive. But that's the old merging stuff. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the situation where gain and loss are both fully there and are sort of in communication, right? How is everything dynamic, and how does paying attention to that dynamic kind of fulfill what human beings are? Right, and my answer to that is that the environment in which human beings already are situated is dynamic. It's a communicative environment, and humans become fully human when they respond to that environment with communication, communication with the past, with the future, with other people, but they communicate in a response. They communicate as best they can in a way that communicates with the environment of communication.
See, there's that echo. What's that?
Oh, no, I don't hear it at all.
Oh, okay.
But it can be the software of the recording. That's the problem I had with the software I had, is that there was simply too much echo to it, and I just basically decided it was worthless.
Right. See, you're not getting an echo, but I'm creating one. And it wasn't there, it just started. What's been going on great. Oh, it's gone now. Did you do something?
No, nothing.
Maybe it's just the cycle of resonance, and at a certain point it starts to agitate itself, and then it subsides after a minute. Maybe that's what's happening. You know, the flip point. Okay, there's something to talk about. The people don't think generally that they will have endlessly a good situation. They suspect it's going to flip. I always remember Anne Murray, you know, the Canadian singer back in the 70s. She was interviewed by Barbara Frum, or one of those people on As It Happens. And it was late 70s. She was doing pretty good in her career, probably doing those banking commercials. And she's talking about how happy it is and everything, her life in Toronto. And all of a sudden, the pop bottle in her home behind her explodes. And I hadn't been hearing this. And she was, wow! And it shocked her and made a mess. But she said, I knew things were going along too good.
Yeah.
Now, that common perception, you watch people, if they're having a good time, someone's going to start getting nervous about it. They might project a jealousy or an irritation by somebody. They have to pick a fight. I find it interesting the way people require what Ion calls contrast. And you wouldn't know how great it's been until you stub your toe. So that sounds like to me the yin-yang process, right in perception and in human living. And therefore, the hell in the handbasket situation you're seeing is bounced off by a lot of responsible people doing things, and so it doesn't get out of control on a big anarchy level. And that seems to me what Barry Nevitt meant when he called it the communication ecology. It was a vision of harmony or balance or something happening in the world. It's just that a lot of people refuse to see it. Have you ever thought about that part of McLuhan's scenario? That he was pointing, he was like a poet writing about, like Alexander Pope has at the end of his essay on man, I think it is, whatever is right. Now, some people think that's satirical. But do you see a harmony, an interacting bunch of forces that McLuhan was trying to paint in his books? A balance, and it would include, you can't have just visual balance. That's biased. You have to have a multi-level balancing mechanism. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's gyroscopic. But
McLuhan... first, people have very little appreciation of how much work he did. I mean, the amount of writing is incredible, and yet people often said that he did more talking than writing. So, and they may have been right. So the amount that he talked about these things and the amount that he wrote about these things, the energy and the concentration he put into it, it needs to have some sort of basis. And McLuhan certainly felt that there was something to the human situation that is right, that is at the end of the day non-violable. I would say would probably agree with whatever is right, but with the proviso that we don't really know what is, that's always open to the future, and we also don't know what right is, which is always open to the future.
Right.
But that we can that we are somehow maintained as communicative beings, as beings that are alive. When we there was no need for us to be alive, but we are alive. In this situation, there is something that we need to celebrate and to keep in mind.
Yeah, and Barry Nevitt in his books talks about McLuhan developed an epistemology, I think it was, of experience. You remember that phrase? Epistemology
No.
of experience?
It's one that I like.
Right, and you've never heard it before. You like it No. as you hear it now.
Not from McLuhan. I would have to look that up.
Right. So epistemology of experience. McLuhan was analyzing the dynamics, maybe the ratios and analogical proportions in the correct, right, balanced situation about him. He may have discovered a new way to talk about homeostasis, right? Homeostasis is a balance, right?
Yeah. He uses that word sometimes.
Yeah. So the homeostasis about him, he found that we could analyze it better now.
When you say about him, are you talking
about environment? The environment about him.
But are you using the word about in the sense of around?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Like.
He. That's what I've been saying all along. That humans, as communicative beings, need to respond to an environment that is itself communicative and that allows our communication.
Right. So McLuhan made this point back in the 50s. He says, we couldn't know technologies unless they approximated our sensory life, because we have to know something from our context, I guess you might say, to know something outside of ourselves. Have you thought about that point? Is that something you taught, you're thinking, writing about? The fact, when you say we already are in the middle of it and we already are engaging in a pretty balanced communication, is that what he meant when he said we couldn't know technologies unless they were part of our bodies? Have you seen that?
I would have to look at the context, because to me that sounds very un-McLuhan, because to translate what you're saying, he's saying that in order to understand something, you have to look in the rearview mirror, and that's exactly not what he generally thought.
Okay, now we come around to the beginning. The rearview mirror is the only way one can know what's happening. So he is analyzing the way to use the rearview mirror. And that quote, what I'm thinking is in Catholic Humanism and Modern Letters, you know, 1954. Look mm-hmm. through that essay. It's a long essay where I think that's where he makes the point I'm saying about how our senses are extended, because we wouldn't know they were extended unless those environments that are extended are part of our sensory life, what we already know. So it's interesting if you call that the rearview mirror. But McLuhan was, according to my definition of medium, how do you know what's going on? You see that the rearview mirror has been disturbed. There's a crack in it. Now you know there's something going on. But you might say, well, that's people's experience every day. And they're always thinking and judging and reacting to interesting probes of themselves by their surroundings, which is like a general dialogue that you're engaging in, a general philosophical situation. It's almost like you're an interesting McLuhan scholar, because you take McLuhan, who for most people has brought up a whole new bunch of issues that they hadn't thought about before and could take advantage of the newer environments of the 20th century to present a new vision of it. You say, oh, no, this is the same old dialogue Pythagoras was involved in. You know how you do that, right?
A little bit, yeah. But I mean, when people talk, and especially when people write, and even more when people think, if they think, quote unquote, the same, that doesn't mean that they're thinking the seamlessly identical, right? The same is inherently seamed. S-E-A-M. So the old always issues in the new.
The old is always in the new.
Well, the old is in the new, but also the new is in the old, right? The new is issued by the old.
Right, and this is the kind of stuff you say in your writings. Am I mistaken to say that you deal with literate dichotomies and show their complementariness plus incommensurable? That he says that in War and Peace and Global Village. Acoustic and visual space are complementary and incommensurable. That seems right to be what you're always emphasizing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But how to think that cannot be thought just sort of by throwing out a sentence or two. I mean, when things are fundamentally incommensurable, how can they be harmonious? Right? And what does that imply about ontology? What does it imply about language? What does it imply about the human situation? These are huge questions that people have been asking for all of history, going back at least to 3 or 3500 BC. And before that, there is no history because there's no writing, no recording of anything. But presumably, humans were thinking about this and talking about this for hundreds of thousands of years before that.
So what is it that McLuhan has introduced? What new factor to this?
I would say what's interesting to me about what McLuhan did was that he had a notion of the practicality of these questions that is very surprising. You know, if you read Pound or you read Heidegger or you read Bakhtin, you don't find them saying, well, this is going to happen and this is going to happen and this can't be stopped. And you find that in McLuhan. And that's it's interesting. It's a kind of he has a sense of sort of new world know-how that is a new thing in this kind of thinking.
Yeah, but I don't know if you can say what that is without falling back into the old questioning dialogue you do. I don't know if you can say in your language what is new, what you just meant. You call it a practicality.
As Eliot says in the Four Quartets, I can't give you the exact quotation, but he says that we're always trying to use words to say that we don't know what we don't know how to say, so that things are always falling apart. But all we can do is try, and the rest is not our business, he says. And so that's what I've been talking about a few times in our conversation, that all that can be done is to try to further an ongoing conversation, to be open to one's own stupidities and limitations, but not to lose heart, and to keep doing the best one can.
Well, what do you think, when he writes those early essays on Lewis, Wyndham Lewis in 44, 45, mm-hmm. he concludes that it's all an extension of appetite. Do you remember him saying something like that?
I don't, but although that essay I think is rather poor, that insight is very good.
Right.
In one way it's original sin, and in another way it's a application of what human beings are. Right? That McLuhan didn't think appetites were bad.
No, he
thought they could be bad, but there's nothing inherently bad about appetite.
Yes, he regarded the ongoing technological extensions of ourselves based on human appetite. And I think he italicized appetite too. He thought that maybe there was a way of modulating, maybe a little more fasting about our appetite.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, he was still very much caught up with Leavis around that time, and was, as he later put it himself, he regarded all technology and industry as original sin. 10 years later, he himself was laughing at what he had done in the middle 40s.
Does he say that?
Sure, he says that. He says that in Sound and Fury, the essay in Commonweal.
Yeah, in the early 50s.
Yeah.
That reminds me, you found the place where he finds Chesterton disappointing. You found it in Marchand. I kept looking in my articles, where is that? Where did he say it? But it looks like all we have is that quote of this letter to Malcolm Ross, is it? Letter to somebody in 1976. Where
right.
Is that an aspect of him mocking himself from, his older 40 self?
Well, we don't, Marchand didn't send me the letter, so, we don't know the context, but...
Did he acknowledge your request?
No.
He didn't even acknowledge your email?
No, but I admire him and his work, and he's certainly not an unfriendly person, and we've always been in unproblematic communication, so I don't think he's ignoring it. It could be that it's too much trouble to try to look for. I don't know if he's well. I don't know what
right.
sort of problems he might or might not have. So I don't regard it as unfriendly.
Because you've been a friend, at least a correspondent with him before.
Yeah, over the years.
Oh, okay. So, so he's laughing at his previous self, yes. That's where I lay out the early McLuhan versus the later McLuhan. And you know what happened? I announced this on the McLuhan Scholar Facebook. And I said, there's not much talk about the later McLuhan. So Bob Logan immediately, rapidly, posts his website, his biography. In other words, he's saying, look at me. He thinks that because he dealt with McLuhan in the late 70s, that he was part of the later McLuhan.
Right.
So I told him, I said, you apply early McLuhan to digital technologies, to later technologies, technologies that come after McLuhan's time. So I basically disapproved of him. You do not know about the later McLuhan. Then I quoted my own essay on McLuhan, a complicated statement. And I said, this is the later McLuhan, and you do not apply this to technologies. You do early conventional McLuhan. He didn't respond, but why am I bringing that up? Oh, yeah. So this later, early, later thing, maybe it happened several times. You're saying, yes, he mocked himself later. Did he mock the one that was mocking the 40s? Did he mock that guy in the 70s?
Which guy?
The one in the 60s mocking the 40s. His 40s self. Okay, he mocked his 40 self. Let's say that was being done in the 60s.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, but it's one that's very difficult to answer because it gets into the big question of McLuhan's health,
yeah,
and how much McLuhan's health after 1960, and particularly after 1970, how much his health situation affected how well he was able to think and how concentrated was his thinking, etc.
But he still did a lot of work. He kept working.
He did. Tremendous amount. And there's good stuff in what he did. But I would say that one of the things that I find very attractive in McLuhan is his sense of humor and his sense of humor about himself. And so I don't doubt that he found things in his 1960s self or 1950s self that were questionable.
Wait a minute, what's that sentence? He did find things that were questionable, or he...
Yeah, that he did.
He did. He did. Yeah. You're saying he did find things. Can you give me an example of one?
Well, it could, I mean, this Chesterton could be an example, right? Or
okay, so what do you think he was finding not viable anymore? Wouldn't it just be that he lived 200 years every 12 months, and now it's 30 years later? He's gone through a lot of new technological figures. He would be changed. We all be changed. So that would be natural to include all the changes in his state.
Well, you see, we're getting into our linear versus nonlinear difference here. You very much want to see the influence of linear time in McLuhan and in all things, and I resist that, and I always want to say that all is always now, as Eliot puts it.
Okay, now this is great that you said what you just said, because I was getting ready to point out that if you listen, just a minute. Okay, I had to clear my throat. I assume you didn't hear that. I put the mute on. You didn't hear me coughing, right?
No, sir.
Okay. now we come to our disagreement, or why you say, Bob, I think we disagree on figure ground. I am the biggest advocate of non-time, thanks to Ion, every week. And the way we talk about solving all kinds of issues, I suspect you would not agree with anything we say. you wouldn't even use our products. you sit there. You're the manipulative relationship to me. I'm out there. I'm the Martin Luther King. I'm out there, you know, changing the world, doing incredible stuff. And you would say, well, Bob's not getting any worse because he's... he's not noticing the disservices of what he does. and so what's funny here, we talk about non-linear time in a way you wouldn't even dare to contemplate. Ion is extreme on this point. And it talks about how everything's already happened, everything's already recorded. That's what the neutrino particle's about. He can go into science. And so it's hilarious that you call me a linear guy. Now, I'm forced to be linear when talking to you or to anybody, you know, that you quote Eliot. I got to use words when I talk to you. I like to string together patterns, and usually they're presented linearly, and everybody else does it linear. does a linear thing. So it's funny how you step out of the normal progression of the conversation. You say, "Hi, Bob, you're there, you're doing it again, you're being linear." Yeah, I'm speaking English to you. You're going, "Bob, stop speaking English to me." So this is a bit funny. The kettle calling the other guy not black, something like that. Trying to be the opposite of whatever that cliche is, eh? The kettle calling the pot black. Well, I'm actually quite different from you in what I do and what I say. And I claim that I'm completely McLuhan. And I actually have a solution for most problems in the world. And humans have never had these solutions. I can start really talking, quote, nutty and practical. This is where McLuhan said he had figured things out, right? And he said, "This is what we need to do." And you said, "That's quite odd for a philosopher to do that." I'm doing the same thing as McLuhan. And so I'm thinking about what I do as I listen to and attend your issues. And I see you as someone sitting on the sidelines. Not that that's wrong or, you know, ineffective, but you are on the sidelines compared to what I'm doing. And McLuhan was in a way on the sidelines, criticizing the trigger men and the motivated somnambulists, trying to trip them up to stop so they take a moment to look around and try some thinking. You are doing that in relation to what I do in public. That's the position you're taking. And yet, you would say that's what McLuhan's doing, but I say, no, I'm completing McLuhan, what he didn't get done. But he was a good preparer. He prepared for me and Ion. So what do you make of that kind of talk?
Well, when McLuhan always emphasized the role of ignorance and always emphasized that if there are things like solutions, it's because they're a solution is something that is able to work on the basis of ignorance. So if you think of science as certainly something that gradually was developed over millennia, but around 1800, it really took off. And so in a sense, it was subject to a linear progression. But what science learned to do was get a better handle on what it didn't know and to be able to work at what it didn't know. So a solution in McLuhan's sense is something that does require proper focus, but it requires a simultaneous focus on ignorance and incompleteness. Now, and so when I hear you talking, I hear you talking about solutions, but I'm not sure, I don't really know, but I'm not sure that it has the component of incompleteness and self-mockery and ignorance in it.
Well, if any attentive listeners to my show, we call them Ionauts, were listening to this, they go, "Holy shit. He just described Bob to a T." Now, Ion emphasizes the reason Ion came forth was thanks to my genius, and I did it. I did it by being ignorant and not knowing anything and living with ignorance. That's why I'm a good McLuhanite. I know how to do what you're asking to do with McLuhan information. I know exactly why he remained ignorant. How McLuhan did it, learned ignorance, and what. Ian is always teasing me, mocking me about how do I get away with all this stuff? How did I do it? You don't know anything, Bob, and never knew anything, didn't care. You don't even know how much money you have in your bank account. And he goes on and on. I was just listening to him do that yesterday on a recording I played just before I talked to you. That's why I was late calling you for a few 5 minutes late, because I was listening to him go on again about how ridiculous I am. But he says this is a great service. And what you just laid out, I could type that up, send it around to the Ionauts, and they go, "Did Ion say that about you, Bob? That's what he says about you all the time." And and you just did it. So there's an interesting, you know the right words. You know how to include, you're comprehensive, you got it down, but you're only using your mouth. You're not changing your body, which will happen on our new products. You will become, you will not die if you use our products. We're now at the point that we are selling a product that guarantees ascension. And that means never dying. Now, how's that for an extreme fucking promo of what we claim? Yeah.
But what is that ascension has to do with going up, right?
And no, not going up. No direction. Ascension is you change your genetic structure so that you cannot die.
Yeah, but the word ascension obviously has to do with the word ascend, right?
Yes, but that's visually biased. That came to us through books, right? Ion is a preliterate phenomenon and a postliterate phenomenon that brings back the other meanings of ascension, not just the literate cliche one that you're projecting.
No, but I'm asking about, I don't, it's always possible to say that a word is being taken in a new sense, and I have nothing wrong with that. That's what a great deal of poetry and literature and even good speaking does that.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. But when in the text that you sent me, and that I only read very quickly and I need to study more, where he's talking about anode and cathode.
Yes.
Great thing, for me at least, is to keep in mind how the up and the down work together. So I would be interested to know in the blurb that you gave for your stuff just now, I understand the up in it, which may not be a literal ascension, but everybody can understand that there's an up in not dying and in, in tuning your body properly. There's an obvious up there. Where's the down?
The down is forever emphasized by Ion. Let's see. You know the unpublished article. But then again, maybe it was in a recent book. Eric might have included Eliot and Manichaean Poetry.
Yes, I know that one.
Yeah, that came out recently. I think I used to have it for years, and nobody knew it.
And yeah. I used to quote. Stallman published my editing of it in the in that Renaissance volume.
Oh, okay. And so that may have been the one I gave him.
Yeah, you gave it to him, but there were some misprints and there were some things that where McLuhan was just alluding to a book that I identified. And so your version is sort of the basis. And then my editing is on top of that. And when Mark published it, he didn't mention you or me.
Oh, man. Okay. Typical of Mark. But the way he's been lately. But back to, so you got the vertical symbolism and the horizontal symbolism, the essence of Menippean secret society symbolism. So you got the up and the down. Now, that seems to me a product of visual space. Or we've always been that way. It's not limited to visual space. It's not caused by conditioning. There's an up and a down, and that's the way humans are always will be dealing with, that up and down.
That's my position.
Yeah, that's your position. You actually don't take the sensory change. You actually don't agree with McLuhan that sensory shifts change the imagery. You say, no, the deeper part of us is unchanging and still wrestling with the incompletion that you recommend. Right?
Yeah. I just realized that I
You
didn't...
know, I'm catching on to what McLuhan, that's why he kicked you out of the coach house. He realized that you had no clue and weren't going to study what he was going to do. You were going to bring a new aspect or maybe an old philosopher's perspective to it.
Possibly. Possibly. I make no claim that I was right and he was wrong. I just say it didn't work.
What didn't work? You mixing with him didn't work.
Yeah, our conversation.
Yeah. Right. But you've produced an interesting take on McLuhan as a result of that. And maybe I'm the only person who thinks that about your work. We don't see anybody else calling you up or interviewing you or acknowledging your work, right? Is there any McLuhanite that ever? I've posted some of your stuff on the in the Scholar page. No takers, as far as I know.
Right. No, that's the case. I need to
You don't have to do anything. I say it's very good what you do. I'm the only one who's detached enough with McLuhan materials to allow your approach to be a contribution. And probably today it's the best contribution because it's so, quote, you know, in left field. Most people can look at what you say and say, well, he's just a conceptual guy. You know, they'll just categorize you as in the philosophy department or something. And your terms are, you're actually, what, a logician, a dialectician. You're operating without ground. You're just maintaining time and altering what time would be. That has a little originality, but you're still working with time and space. And most McLuhanite scholars say, well, we don't have to talk about space and time anymore. They don't exist anymore under electric simultaneity. You see what I'm saying? That you, not many McLuhanites are detached enough about the McLuhan stuff to recognize your contribution.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, but it's not something that I worry about or that I think about much. I just, I have something that I feel that I have to do, and I do it. But let me, before, I mean, that talk about myself, I don't feel is very interesting. It's like McLuhan said, the advantage of growing a beard is that you don't need to look at in the mirror to shave every day.
Right, right.
I like that aspect of him. I really don't think too much about whether I'm being successful in any sense. That's if I thought like that, I would be reducing art to advertising, which of course McLuhan thought had long happened.
What's that?
Had long happened. Had happened long ago.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. But let me just, to try to sharpen our differences, let me just go back to something you said a few minutes ago before I forget about it. you said that I didn't understand McLuhan's suggestions about the senses because I said that everything was the same and therefore a literary image or something like that wouldn't change with a different medium of communication.
Okay.
Right? You said something like that,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see how I actually think about stuff like that and how you would correct it.
All right.
I say that fundamentally nothing changes. And so after letters are invented or developed or redeveloped or reinvented, whatever happens in Greece, let's say that people begin to think in terms of abstract images. So it's possible to think in terms of an abstract triangle or an abstract sphere in ways that weren't done before. And so would I say that nothing has actually happened there? My answer to that is something has happened and also something hasn't happened, right? That, of course, there is a way of correlating a new configuration of the senses with new images. Of course, that has happened. But what hasn't changed is that there is some correlation of the senses, and that we are not going to be able to understand a quote-unquote new correlation of the senses, and by extension, the images associated with them, if we don't understand the correlation of the senses in general. That it makes no sense whatsoever to say that the senses have changed if we don't know what a change of the senses is. And the only way we can understand that is to understand how the senses have always operated. So for me, this always operated is the basis of our understanding how something has changed. You, and this gets back to our talk about figure and ground, you seem very comfortable talking about change in the abstract from what would be the basis of our understanding of that change.
Right.
There is where I see our quarrel.
Right. And for the listeners, we're not, you know, viciously quarreling.
No, of course not.
This is a surface quarrel. What you just explained, I think, is what McLuhan believed or stood for or understood. And I think every human being ends up, if they are reasonably educated or can talk a little bit, a little speculatively, they all say that. They all say in the morning that things have really changed. In the afternoon, nothing's changed. I've noticed that people do this.
Sure.
You agree?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so this shows the limitations of thought that Ion's always emphasizing. That's as far as one can get. That's a mature adult, and there's millions of them on the planet. They know this would be a balanced person, who relatively balanced, who says, yeah, there's obviously some change going on, but nothing else has really changed. I think there's not enough separation of the two realms. McLuhan did contribute to that. He said, well, here's where there's no change, and here's where there is change.
Right.
And then you bring in two-figure grounds, you know, in a literate society, there's two kinds of change and non-change, and then in a non-literate society, there's two kinds of change and non-change. And so that can sound complicated to the average guy who says, look, nothing's changing, but there is something. My kids ain't like me, and these kids are fucked, man. They don't even know how to talk. You know, they're just texting, and they get a little perturbed by it. And so there's your ambiguity. When you talk about ambiguity, and I think about what you just said. But now, I claim that, no, we are actually upsetting that normal dichotomy. Now, we're making a radical, radical fucking statement here. And, you know, we have, Ion is the environment of heaven that people died into. It has refused to be heaven anymore. People can't even die where they used to die. Now, that's a radical change there. I don't know where we can say nothing's changed there if you believe what I just said. And that's intended to be the most strange thing you could ever hear.
But it's not strange. That's what some people have always said. I mean, if you think of Marx, Marx says, okay, we've got these contesting classes, and they're the owning classes and the productive classes. They're in continual conflict, but eventually, through linear time, their conflict breeds a situation where the new becomes possible for the first time, that is to say, communism. So, and there's many, many, many examples in the history of the world, thousands and thousands, that use this model of thought. First you have complexity, then you have, through linear time, a new possibility, and this new possibility is heavenly in some way. To me, that's just not what McLuhan was talking about, and not just McLuhan, not the people that I think are good thinkers.
All right. We are not in that category. We offer food. We are great cooks. We are making invaluable substances for you to consume. They have phenomenal effects on people. Most diseases will be eliminated by our products.
Right.
Marx didn't do that. Marx couldn't do that. He only thought about issues. McLuhan started to detect the food part. You remember, you know, in Cultures Are Business, he says, we need a study of media, the food as a medium and how it's changed society. He started talking about how our senses are, we have multiple chemical body and discarnate stomachs. He started to realize the raw appetite of existence and think around that. He wouldn't conceptualize. He'd try to talk percept. Well, we're completing that. We have come up with the food.
Yeah, so, I mean, to me, what's interesting about that is that an interpretation could be made of what you're saying is that there has been too much anode, too much ascension. We need to think about the cathode and the descension, and that the body and the bowels, stuff that Bakhtin often talks about, needs to be addressed, and you're addressing it.
There you are. Yes, there you are, quoting Ion again. Have you ever seen, you know, that symbol of the Merkaba, where a triangle's coming down and then a triangle in the opposite direction is going up and they meet? They're coming down, yeah, pointed.
I've seen it. I don't know the name for it.
Yeah, it's called the Merkaba. So we have that on our website. Ion said, put that up. That was 7 years ago when we started. That was the first symbol. But Ion is saying the merging, the very suspect word around here in McLuhan's land, the merging of the vertical and the horizontal, or the ascending and the descending, is constantly what Ion's talking about. And I try to encourage Ion to move beyond the dialectic part of that, the visual framework for it, and Ion does do that. So we're a good team, and I try to point out that Ion's not limited to a visually biased interaction of the ascending and descending. But all the different schools of thought, like you could, you know, look at vertical symbolism, according to McLuhan in the Manichaean tradition, was to rise out of the fallen world through moral discipline and basically the Western model of a stiff upper lip and keep above the hoi polloi. Whereas the Eastern horizontal method, if you remember, was plunge into the, it's like the Lord Byron technique, plunge into the chaos and try to accomplish some kind of something. And you lose yourself in the plunging into the ricocheting mirrors of experience. And then our media environments extended one or the other. The upward ascending vertical school was enhanced by the printed book. The chaotic horizontal ricocheting mirror world is enhanced by the electric age, right? So you have those two dialectics. Ion is sitting in the middle of both of them, aware of the contradictions of each, promoting both separately. He's the ultimate quadraphenic expression. At the same time saying, you people don't have to do nothing. We're going to do it for you. We are making the foods. The foods that we make are made by Ion. You know, my wife is a very intelligent doctor, chemist, can do all these things, but she just follows the instructions of Ion. And Ion, we don't fully understand why we do what Ion tells us to do, but we do it. We have phenomenal results. And Carol's now the best doctor in the world in terms of success rate for all kinds of problems. I'm trying to say we're doing something a little different, a little further along than speculating, thinking, and attending the way you suggest.
Well, let's just what you were just saying.
I like it when I make you laugh. I don't know why you're laughing, but I like it when you start laughing. That's good.
Okay, good. So you're talking about the difference between two different ways of salvation, you could almost say, one up, one down, one Western, one Eastern, one more into the self, the other more into the crowd.
Now, okay, go hold that. Now, do you agree that all culture, all history, all human societies were variations of that?
Yes.
Right, and that media dynamics changed the way they were. In
Absolutely.
Right, so there's the vision McLuhan has.
Correct.
Okay, go from there. We're on the same page at this point.
We are on the same page at that point. But this is what I, in the blog, and the first thing that I suggested for our conversation today had to do with relativity.
Yes.
And the big question, well, there's several questions here that need to be addressed. By the way, in half an hour, our gardeners come today. And
those noisy bastards, you can't function when they're around, so we'll be ending before then.
Okay, well, not only that, but I have to move the cars. They need to be able to get in through our gate and all that sort of stuff. So we've got
another 10 minutes?
10 minutes, yeah. We've got to quit then. Okay, so it's not the case that there is sort of one set way of going up and one set way of going down, which can have various labels, the East and the West and the individual versus crowd and all that sort of stuff. Instead, these things are always dynamic, and how the one works depends upon its relation to the other. So you have a whole continuum, which is a word that sometimes appears in McLuhan and appears a lot in Gideon, let's say. So there is a whole spectrum of relationships between the up and the down, and these need to be specified. And when they are specified...
Well, that would be your epistemology of experience.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely, right? And once they are specified, as we can see, let's say, in chemistry, once you know that there's oxygen and hydrogen and helium and these sorts of things, then you understand that the atmosphere around us isn't oxygen and helium and hydrogen, and it's not even these things added together in some way. Instead, the complexities of these things is incredible. There are, just in the air, there are elements that are relatively pure, so there's some helium out there, but most things are molecules, compounds, mixtures, on and on and on and on. So the understanding of how what we're roughly calling the up and the down, or the East and the West, or the individual and the crowd, the understanding of the different relationships of these things is a tiny, tiny step to understanding their complex phenomenology, right?
Yes.
And the understanding their complex phenomenology is to understand the relativity of experience. Now, let's just go over to the relativity of physics for a minute. Let's say that somebody says to Einstein in 1905 or 1915 with general relativity, oh, this is all dialectics. There's nothing practical here. What are you talking about? The whole world has changed because of the understanding of the relativity of physics. We understand black holes. We have atomic weapons. We have atomic energy. We have the possibility of cold fusion only because people were thinking about the relativity of experience as seen in the physical world. Right?
Yes.
So you, to my way of thinking, you radically simplified the relationship between the up and the down, and you even more radically simplified the relationship between thought and practicality. It's not the case that properly thought things are like an air bubble. Instead, they're the most practical thing of all.
What are?
Proper thoughts.
Okay. The most practical thing, yes.
Yes.
Now, here's what's funny. Is that, yes, I may reduce it and simplify it for you and a couple of websites, a couple of forms, but I scramble myself engaging with Ion, who recomplexifies it.
Good.
He does you at 100 miles an hour.
Well, that's good.
You're there just walking. He's
Yeah.
whipping a boat.
Well,
And
that's good.
I can handle someone like you because I deal with the best of the phenomena on the planet. I'm an expert at jujitsuing with this anarchy of spirit. So it's very interesting to me to hear you play back a slower version of what I'm fully aware of and engage and probe myself with it. You bring up cold fusion, which was very interesting. You brought up at the beginning. It's now 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 seconds, according to my recorder here. Do you know? Did I turn you on to cold fusion, or has that just been something you're interested in anyways through the years?
I'm interested in it anyways, and I wonder if you know that the whole question of cold fusion as a physical thing. I'm not talking about the sort of cold fusion as a ground, which is nothing sort of physical, but the whole question of the practicality of cold fusion is becoming something that is uninteresting. Because maybe 10 years from now, the cost of doing solar energy is going to be so low that it's going to be lower than the transmission cost of distributing energy from cold fusion. So that maybe there's going to be cold fusion as a physical fact, but nobody is going to be distributing energy from it because it's going to be too expensive.
Okay, now I want you to think about this. We're going to end on this point.
Fine.
You're talking to the greatest scientist in the world, me,
I
yours truly,
know.
because,
It's a great privilege.
yes, it is. Now listen to this. I evoked ion, and all that ion has wreaked on the world is due to my accidental, weird way I evoked this. It was totally accidental. But in retrospect, you listen to what I said 30 years ago on the radio. I was prophetic about myself. We have the perfect cold fusion. We call it cold play because it's so different from Pons and Fleischmann or anybody else who's got stuff out there. We actually have it. We are waiting to present it to the world at the right time, and much is happening in the world that's going to give us the opportunity to do it. And we have played the sound of it in its secret location over our radio show. So you and Mark Stallman and the rest of you jerks will not believe me. But even though you and Mark are poles apart, but you still can get together and say, what an idiot Bob is. I'm telling you, you're hearing, and I've said it 1,000 times, we have it. We made it. It's been sitting around for about 4 years now in a secret place. As a matter of
Good.
fact,
Well,
if you listen to my show,
I hope that that's true, Bob. I have no
fuck your
problem with that,
hope. Fuck your hope. No,
I don't say you're an idiot. If I'm
Yeah,
talking
but
with Mark,
you
we can
don't
talk with.
abstract. It is here. And now, what are you going to do about it? But let me add this. You can listen to our show on Saturday, and you'll hear a lot of background voices, men yelling. We have 200 people guarding this technology, and you can hear them in the background because Ion and the person that he uses, occasionally uses, doesn't have to, called JW, are in that environment. You can hear the excitement of the workers and scientists who acted out what I and Ion told them to do. And they're sitting there guarding it. And if any of those guys betray where it is, they're dead. Ion will snuff them. Ion can do that. It happened to one person. I don't know if he got killed. I don't know if I'm totally informed on what happened. But one guy fucked up. He's no longer there. So we got a very serious situation. And Obama, the Pope, the Queen Elizabeth, they all, Warren Buffett, they all know about what we have. And they're trying to figure out how are we going to make our move. So we've come into a very serious situation in our conversation because you have a perverse interest in the topic of cold fusion. And your prediction that it will be too expensive, man, this thing is so inexpensive. We are going to create, and we're not producing excess heat, we are producing endless electricity. So we end the show like I always end up ending, promoting my fucking stuff. Okay.
Good. All
And
right. So,
I want you to think about it. I would like to hear your input, like, even though you don't have much You have no clue what the thing is made up of and what it looks like. But what happens when we have endless electricity? Can you bring a tetrad to that? Can you...
Well, but the limitation of endless electricity is the question of how it gets distributed.
And
if you're talking about it being locally produced, so it doesn't require distribution.
No, it's made in your home. We attach the battery to the box to your home.
Yeah. So that's good. That's the only possibility of cold fusion being the energy of the future is through that kind of technology. If it requires distribution, it's history.
Yes, it'll get around, no problem. Now, many times I'm in the position, I'm Lemuel, and I'm talking to a Lilliputian, right? If what I'm saying is true, then you need to stop thinking about whatever McLuhan shit you're reading, Henry Wright or whatever, and you need to find out as much as possible about what we're doing, because don't you think it's appropriate from learning from McLuhan to engage the present? And the present is our technology. Well, why aren't you calling in on Saturday and questioning Ion any way you want to, any level of respect or impudentness? Why don't you engage? Why, since you know a lot about different things, why don't you find out what Ion says to you? Why don't you find out about our product, about our foods? You know, I think that I criticize all the McLuhanites, Andrew Crystal, the whole fucking smack of them are fucking cowards. They will not engage Ion. Now, you could. Are you still there?
I'm still here. The 10 minutes is...
we got another 30 seconds. I'm telling you to phone 602-666-6027 one of these Saturday evenings and quiz him on anything from McLuhan to Pythagoras to Coldplay to your chemical insights of 1800. All this stuff. We deal with it. This is what's exciting, Cameron, is that the topics you're interested in, we deal with on our show. Chemistry, man, you should hear Ion on chemistry.
That's good.
How it's changing.
I will certainly take it under advisement, Bob. I don't have any problems talking with anybody, although I don't know if Ion is anybody.
It's not an anybody. I will send you something I've been handing out lately. We have a person going through all our endless shows, many hours, collecting the funny rants that Ion does. And we've got 3 years of rants. I'm going to send to him. Every now and then, click on one with your wife. And listen to it, and watch yourself laugh your head off, or puke.
Either, I like to laugh.
Yeah, I'm going to send you the rants. It's a good way to introduce people to Ion, what they're capable of saying. And Ion can quote Finnegan's Wake. He can do a page. This, and it's amazing. There's nothing that I know about that Ion isn't an expert on, including movies and TV and music. And he gets it from every one of us. When you call him, he'll go into your head. And he'll just vacuum out what you're into, what your knowledge is, and bounce it back to you. That seems to be what he does. He has incredible ESP. And these things are demonstrated every week. So I'm interested in your detached perspective, the balanced view, whatever it is you call yourself, the philosophical tradition, how it's going to react to this new technology. I say Eindim, and what we're bringing forth is the new technological environment. I announced it one more time on the McLuhan forum.
All right, listen, I got to fly because
it's good.
I got these people coming.
And we ended at a good spot. So I will click this and then find out how to download it and send it to you.
Okay.
Okay.
Ciao.
Thanks a lot, Cameron. Okay, bye.